If the committee will come to order and the members of the committee will please take your seats. I apologize for running behind. I'll go ahead and confess I had to make sure I filed my economic interest statement today or they would take my name off the ballot. So I'd been weighing that all day, you know. The escape clause. Before we get started, would like to, of course, welcome our sergeants at arms from the House, Bob Rossi, Carlton Adams, and Martha Gaddison, and from the Senate, Jim Blackburn and Steve Wilson. And as always, we appreciate their assistance. I believe you should have in front of you the minutes from the February 13th meeting. If you have those, would entertain a motion to approve by anyone. Okay. Senator Tucker moves that they be approved without objection. Seeing none, the minutes are approved. Couple of items that I've got here from the from our staff, so I'll give these to you. Be sure when you are speaking that you speak into the microphone and get it over there close to you. The reason why that's important is that for the purposes of the transcripts and the minutes, Ms. Hobby needs to be able to hear those very clearly. She does an excellent job with the minutes, but sometimes you have to sort of go back and check what was said, and we want to make sure that we've got you appropriately recorded. The other comment is, of course, is to take the contents of your folders, but if you would leave your folders, that would make it much easier for the staff as they put your materials in for the next meeting. And, of course, be sure to get your reimbursement forms to Ms. Hobby before the end of the meeting or at the end of the meeting, and she'll be able to get those appropriately processed. Now, what we want to try to do today, we've spent a great deal of time working the last couple of meetings on the governance board. We want to spend the bulk of our time on some of the other barriers, some of the other issues. And we greatly appreciate all of the phone calls, emails, the suggestions that have been flowing in after every meeting. What we have in front of you, what should have in front of you is a and I'll just launch on into this. Does anybody have a preliminary question before we launch on into our business? If not, we'll launch on into our business. What you have in front of you is a two-pager that is recommendations for LME, or really, I guess it should be LME, MCO, or maybe MCO governing boards. This is a compilation of all of the committee's discussion to this point, and really what I want to do is I just want to move through this very quickly and then sort of set it aside and come back to it toward the end of the meeting, because I think it's very important for us to get out on the table some of the other issues that we had identified in the first meeting that we need to address, and I want to make sure that we've got our thoughts there and see if there's some areas that there that we can have some agreement upon and get those checked off in a sense. This recommendation, I'll just run down through it very quickly. It would have a size limitation, no fewer than 11, no more than 21, trying to address both the flexibility issue without having boards that are unwieldy. I think there was quite a bit of consensus around three-year terms and that those would apply to everyone. I think there was quite a bit of consensus around board training with participation, obviously, by the department in that and by the School of Government. We appreciate you volunteering for that. no objection from the School of Government, I'm sure. Also, addressing attendance and action on behalf of the board, being the board being able to take action in a case of someone who has is not attending, and then of course the appointing authority would be able to replace at that point. In terms of board composition, I believe we have 11, I think, identified here. Areas of either expertise that we want to see on the boards, and this comes from our rather exhaustive exercise of talking about what kinds of skills need to be on these boards. Because one thing, and I think I may have even misspoke last time, I think last time I might have said or said before small insurance companies, but it's really not. These are insurance companies. Now, they're public service insurance companies. They're something very different, really, in my mind. It's sort of a different animal. But it is an insurance company, and a rather substantial one at that, a rather substantial enterprise. And I just think that simply underscores the type of both, and based on the services that are being provided, having that financial, the assurance that you have the appropriate financial expertise on there as best we can, medical expertise on there, obviously, county commissioners, which will still make up a large share, maybe a majority of the board, and assuring representation from the three major areas that from the CFAC, from the consumers and families. And I think that, I don't know if it's clear in here, but I think the idea would be is one person would be a consumer, a family from mental health, one from DD, and one from substance abuse, so that those major areas would be covered from CFAC individuals who are working with those consumer groups and families, so that you have the you've got the range of expertise and community involvement and impacted individuals on the committee. There would be in here, and like I say, we can come back and maybe talk about this a little bit more toward the end, and our consultant, Ms. Porter, Dr. Porter, is available to help explain a few things as well if I get stuck. But we would have essentially two models in there. There'd be two slight variations to this. The expertise would be in either of the models. You would have the requirement for that type of expertise to be there, but you would have as much flexibility, I think, as we could reasonably put in, while at the same time ensuring that we have the representation that I think everyone is looking for, or most people are looking for in these. The governance boards. The final item that you'll see on here is the, of course, the meetings per year, saying no fewer than 6 meetings per calendar year. They could obviously have more than that, but that's at least one meeting every 2 months. And I think that particularly starting out, and particularly given the, and they may, I'm sure would probably starting out, maybe some of these would want to have one every month, but at least once every 2 months, given the responsibilities and the scope of what is being undertaken. So with that, what I'd like to do is kind of set that aside and let you sort of cogitate on that, and we'll come back to that toward the end of the meeting and get some further comments or observations or questions on that. I want to next go into get back to what we had at the first meeting when we were talking about potential barriers at issue. Do they have the sheet of the barrier? Okay, let me suspend my comments for a moment and let them pass this out. Thank you. I just make a technical remark in case you're wondering. Any of these items, what we'd be working toward is taking these concepts and reducing them to actual legislative language. So before the committee would pass judgment on any particular proposal, we would have that in legislative language format. Mr. Parker is diligently working on that. So that you can see it in actual statutory language, because that I know that makes a big difference. Okay. Everybody have that? Okay. Under item number one, and I'm just going to kind of... I shouldn't read this, but I'll do it anyway. I'll just read through this real quick, and I want to open it up to some questions or comments. I'll give you a comment, and then I want to hear what committee members may have to say. Some of these we may be able to come to some consensus on rather quickly. Maybe some others not. The statute requires multiple agreements among multiple counties to form the LME-MCO. All participating counties must agree each time another county is added to the organization. Of course, as you know, this is an area that we've discussed a lot because it's complex and time-consuming. And any one county under the current system, at least for a time, could block a merger and a waiver expansion by withholding merger approval. And I think that some of our discussion in the past has been that we want to get away from the unanimity requirement currently in the statute. And what I've been hearing most from folks is to have those mergers be approved by two-thirds of the vote of the comprising county commissioner boards. In other words, the boards, I assume, by simple majority, but you would, if you had two-thirds of the boards of the county commissioners approving a merger, that would be sufficient, as opposed to having to have unanimity among all of the counties in a LME that is merging with another LME in creating an MCO. Do we have any comments or our thoughts on that particular barrier? Well, if not, I won't cast it in stone, but I'm going to check it off as something that we'll put together legislative language to that effect, and you can be thinking about it if you have a different point of view that you want to express at a later time. Under item number two there, it says any single LME can dissolve the LME-MCO at any time for any reason, potentially disrupting the waiver operations. That's the current issue. That's one of the current issues that's out there. And the situation is less clear for multi-county MCOs. If a group of counties join together to form an LME-MCO, it may be that the remaining counties would have to reform to establish another LME, potentially leaving the state in the interim with full responsibility for waiver operations. And that's a lot of language to say that we're in a very delicate, I think everybody agrees, that we're in a very delicate transition time. So the question is, if you've got a joining for the purposes of an MCO, or at least as I see it, you've got a joining for a potential MCO, you know, for an MCO, and then you have somebody saying, oh, well, we want to get out of that. Once you've got the MCO put together, there are just tremendous financial considerations there and service considerations for the consumers and their families, and obviously deep concerns in terms of, you know, what position it would put the state in at that point. And one of the concepts that's been put out there that I think would be an idea for us to explore and look at would be to say that what we would have is a 2-year moratorium on any disengagement from an LME MCO. So in other words, it would be a two-year moratorium from January 1 of 2012 this year to no later than June 30th of 2014 for any disengagement from an LME MCO. And in doing that, what we would do is task the departments, the counties, the LME MCOs to work together on a process by which counties could disengage from an MCO, because there's been quite a bit of discussion and a lot of feedback and a lot of conversations about counties wanting to be able to retain a degree of independence in that if they really believe an MCO is not serving their purposes and is not serving their, and they can't get it worked out, that at some point in time they would have the opportunity to move to an MCO that would be a better, that they believe would be a better fit for them. Of course, the problem with that is that once you set, and I'm not a financial expert, don't pretend to be one, but I'm sure the department could comment on this, but once you set up an MCO and you put all of that financial structure together, you start pulling it apart. You know, it's, you get into quite a bit of difficulty in getting the finances right. Plus, I think there's a lot of considerations about, okay, what would be just cause or what would be the appropriate cause to allow a county or counties to disengage. And I know that this has been a concern on a lot of people's part. So it would seem to me that if we did a moratorium in this very difficult period of time, and that moratorium, by the way, could be lifted at any point. I mean, it could be lifted by the at any time during the General Assembly, for example, in the regular session next year, so it wouldn't necessarily have to last for 2 years. But you would probably want it to last until the counties and the LMEs and the department can come up with a methodology for how you would disengage that would be logical and preserve everyone's interest, and get that down on paper and agree to, and put in place any enacting language that would be required. Senator Tucker.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Your discussion here at this juncture is a segue into my question in talking about whether or not counties would like to choose to disengage from an MCO because it's not working. My question is, does DHHS have a logistical team set up with parameters and benchmarks in place that in the event that these bureaucracies who are now transitioning into insurance companies and the state taking on the responsibility, if they are their benchmarks and triggers for the state to go in and disengage that management team if they're not performing their duties, and to be able to make sure that the consumer is continuing with services and the providers are getting paid by choosing someone to discern what payments need to be made and what not. And in other words, you know, Senator Nesbitt, my friend from Buncombe County, has been dealing with this a long time, and I take to heart that there's an opportunity when you move from a bureaucracy to a quasi-private public entity, there's an opportunity for some things to happen and actually an MCO fail. So I would like to know whether or not someone from DHHS has had the foresight and the planning to determine if one of these MCOs blow up, that they have a team that can go in and run it and displace the team that's there and keep things moving until it can be adjusted. Because if we're out of session and they don't have those guidelines and it's not worked on and it's not in legislation and they don't have that authority or reluctant to have that authority, we could have a bad situation and we not even know about it. Now, I bought into the waiver. I bought into PBH's system, but they've had 6 years. These people had a year and a half maybe or maybe 2 years. I personally think that, you know, they don't need another year to transition, because if they're going to fail, they're going to fail pretty quickly. So that's my question. Has anybody on DHHS thought about this? Has anybody in our leadership thought about this? And do we have safeguards that are in place that they can move quickly as a team to straighten out the mess that's there, if one is created?
Dr. Melcher will answer that question.
Thank you, sir. We are working. There's two things, two components to what you're asking. One is, do we have benchmarks? And we are developing benchmarks in terms of what does failure look like and how would we know it. And our intent is to work those into the next contract so that everybody is very clear about what that would be. And then the second piece is a team to move in. I think the way the waivers work is that if we saw a failure happening, it's not going to happen in one day. We would probably see it emerging. And our intent would be to identify an alternate MCO to start picking up the management of that entity. We would not see ourselves running this for a long time, but we certainly would work with other MCOs to be able to take over that operation. Dr. Gray, do you want to
follow up? Dr. Belcher, do you need legislation to have that authority to do that? You know, I really think you do, because the last $1 billion debacle we've had, and I'm just new here, so I've heard that over and over again. We have some of the same people running the MCOs that managed through that catastrophe. I'm just saying, I would like to see legislation and work with you. And I'll be glad to sponsor it, to be able to outline what that team looks like, what your benchmarks are. You can tell from cash flow. You can tell from services preeminent to the failure coming. But, I mean, in September, you know, I don't want to sponsor a law or legislation that's not there, but I don't want to come back here next year, Dr. Belcher, and you say, well, we really didn't have the authority to eliminate those folks. We didn't have the authority to make those hard choices. You know, the State Personnel Act is this, Senator, this and this and this. If you need the authority to do that, to save the MCO so the services can be met, I'm willing, along with Chairman Dollar, to, you know, put some legislation in process and you know, have a collective effort between consumers, providers, and you guys, instead of you guys out there running Lone Ranger, because quite frankly, you've been running it for a long time and it hasn't worked well. I don't mean anybody had a plan to have the things that happen, but you know, do you have a group of approved MCO teams that can come in and process claims and get them paid, those kind of things there. And if you need that legislation, I'm willing to do that. I want to do that, because I can see this happening. There is no way in my mind, in my one short year in this Senate, that a bureaucracy can come a public-private enterprise and move quickly to resolve problems like it needs to, like it's going to have to resolve in this new scenario. So I'm open. I don't want to micromanage your business. I don't want to do that. But I am fearful that, you know, you guys may not move as quickly as need be, and we want this all to work and be easier on the consumers, the providers, and the folks running DHHS. Am I off base here in my thought process?
Well, we can certainly have additional conversations. I think that even if things were put in statute, we would want to have it in the contract, because that is our relationship. That's the relationship that we have with the MCO and the grounds by which we would be able to terminate their participation in the waiver. So regardless, we need to have those benchmarks in a contract. Again, in terms of a team, if you're talking about people to analyze the data for us to determine whether or not those benchmarks are met, you know, I think between the divisions, we have the capacity and already are collecting that kind of data to review. Again, I would not see us as actually running a waiver from across the street or from the DMA building, but that we would work with other MCOs to transition the management of whatever failed MCO were to occur. But we can certainly talk about whether there are pieces of that that need to be in statute. I think regardless, we will proceed to put things into the contract.
Hang on, what's it? Well, do you want to, Mr. Jordan?
Let Steve do it. Now, Steve, I'm going to put you on the spot. I ask you about strengthened residential replacement laws and our study group that has not met since I passed that law. So tell me you're going to do that. Tell me it's going to happen. Give me a timeline and then tell me what else you're going to say, because otherwise I won't hear anything you say.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Tucker. One of the things, as after you've spoke to me about the work group, have had my folks looking to find where it is that the work group is listed, because personally I hadn't been able to find it, but we are looking to see where that is in the work group so that we can get moving with that. The second thing is N-122C, I do not know the specific citation, but there is the availability for the secretary to intervene when a LME starts having financial difficulty. So that's there. If more specificity needed to be added, that may be the place to go start looking in regards to that.
Well, in response, number one, to your first response, I can help you find the study team. I'll do that. You just need to contact my office and let me know, and I'll find that for you. Secondly, did not the secretary have the authority as well back in 08 and 07 when we went through this to be able to step in and try to correct that situation as well? I'm just afraid, and also too, I haven't been around here long enough, like Representative Insko and all these people who have the history like you do. I want to trust DHHS to do it, but I'm just having a difficult time coming from the private sector, understanding how a bureaucracy is going to overnight transition into a public-private insurance company and run.
Well, let's do this. Let's we will get the staff between now and our next meeting to take a look at that specific question and that process, and maybe see if we can get some additional clarity on that, on exactly what is the authority that is there now, either currently existing in 122 or existing as part of the bill that we passed last year, and if there's any ambiguity or there is some question there as to whether or not there's appropriate authority to act in the instance of an MCO failing or appearing to be in the process of failing, then, you know, we can take a look at what legislation might be, you know, just to clarify that if that's needed. So we'll work on that. And I'm not sure about the other question, but I think y'all are going to work that out. I do have – yes, sir.
Dr. Belcher, you said that you do not perceive you running an MCO. Are you telling me that you would take another MCO management team or a remnant of that and transfer it over to the MCO to be running it? Or are we talking about displacing people who actually mismanage an MCO? They're gone, and then new ones are put in place until we can get up to speed? I mean, what's that involvement look like?
Well, I'll make an attempt, and then I'm sure Dr. Gray can help me out, too. Again, remember, we have a contract with an MCO. If they fail on that contract, they are out of compliance with the contract. We, therefore, can contract with someone else to do that job. So we would probably initially look at another MCO to see if they could pick up the management of that area instead of the current team that was there.
I want to ask a follow-up question along, Dr. Melcher, from what you said initially. You were talking about putting in benchmarks, I'm assuming benchmarks that do not currently exist, into the next contract. Could you explain that? Because I'm not sure I'm following you in terms of, are you saying the next contract for the next group that overall – the next group that converts? Are you saying the next contract that's done with all of the LME MCOs, and what would be the timetable for that, and or have those benchmarks been developed?
Well, we have a set that we're looking at right now. I think that as the contracts come up for renewal, we would add those in. Certainly, we could do that immediately with the folks that are coming on board, but then as PBH's contract comes up, we could amend that and add that to it.
So someone that would currently have a contract or just engaged in a contract, those could be added to that contract as soon as they're developed?
We could have that conversation with them about amending that contract, yeah. Am I right, Dr. Gray? Yeah.
Dr. Gray.
Just to add to this conversation, Representative Dollar and Senator Tucker, the monitoring process for a new MCO is fairly rigorous. So weekly contact and observations on both their business management and their clinical processes. Now, a company that is well established, such as PBH, we do not monitor them weekly, but we look at them on a quarterly basis. And if we see trends, we have the capacity within the authority over PBH to monitor them weekly if we need to as well. But we don't, because we have sufficient data gathered on a quarterly basis. In addition to that, we have the capacity of what we call shadow claims, that are claims that are that the MCO pays coming will be coming into the HP system, and we will have that database to monitor them independently of whatever information they give us. So there are two ways we can monitor them directly. The other thing I want to comment on, Senators and Representatives, is this. That is that This is not a purely intergovernmental transaction. It is a relationship between a contractor and a contractee, and therefore it gives the contract holder, that is the department, significant more authority to directly manage problems and to encourage successes than we've had in previous relationships.
If I might follow up, Dr. Gray, on that, what you were just saying, a couple of things, if you don't mind. One, when the new MMI system is up and running, am I correct in my understanding that instead of looking at shadow claims, you will be able to look at and track real-time transactions? Is that correct?
Yes and no, Representative Dollar. The claims are still managed and processed through the local management company's informatics system. But we will get those same claims at the same time or closely thereto that they receive them, so we'll be able to track behind them what they're doing in terms of claims management. Their claims are separate from the MMIS system. And as far as the shadow claims are concerned, as we call them shadow claims, those will be coming in immediately rather than waiting until 2013, July, when the MMIS system comes up.
And to follow up, just to get a clarification in terms of adjustments to the contracts, and when these, because the benchmarks aren't currently finalized, but you've had you've had LME MCOs that are in the process or already have or getting ready to, be the MCOs. Is there any impediment whatsoever from getting those benchmarks once they are finalized by the department put in to any and all of the contracts, irrespective of where those contracts are in the process, if they've already been signed, what have you? Because I think that at least part of what Senator Tucker is getting to is that, if there's a piece there that's missing that we know needs to be there in order to track the progress, is there any impediment whatsoever of making sure that those get into those contracts? I hope I'm being clear with my question.
And the answer to that is no, there is no impediment, because the contract specifically allows for the amendments to be done based upon the current or future changes that we have to make to achieve that objective of putting the benchmarks in place. We have that relationship now with Piedmont. If we find something, we can amend that contract as well.
Thank you. Let me move to Ms. Coker has been very patient and had a question. It may have even changed by now.
Maybe the list grew. But first of all, I keep hearing this phrase. Oh, and I just wanted to say, Senator Tucker, I hear so much that I like to hear from him, because there's so much in the last few years that has gone on that I believe could have been prevented. I think that there is actually already existing statute that's just not been regarded. And it's hurt us because maybe there's not enough of a respect of statute and policy in our state in a lot of ways. But it's unfortunate that because there's not been enough teeth in places, there are just things that have been disregarded that could have been helpful. I guess part of what brought this to my mind is that we already had a situation with the LMEs ahead of the waiver that whereby the LMEs had a contract with DHHS. And Representative Insko worked pretty hard to help put more teeth and benchmarks in language. I guess, was that 2006 or 7? Okay. And I was on the commission at the time. And the report we got from a staff who's no longer at the department, the language they came up with was just every bit, it may have been a little bit closer to detail, but it still remained open-ended. So it didn't put any more teeth in. It didn't help at all. And as somebody that's unfortunately became real system aware very early, but powerless because of position in my community, it's like we could see so much of what was not there that should have been there. And then you start studying statute, as some idiots like I did so much, and you find out that there's actually a bit in the statute already that just isn't really regarded or doesn't quite have enough strength to it. So that, for instance, is it 122C 118 where the secretary's role is defined, Mark, or what?
I can't remember the citation, but there is a powers and duties statute for the secretary. It's not 122C 118. I think 122C 112, something.
I think that's the other thing I was thinking. But anyway, in that section, it talks about the secretary having the powers and the duties to go in and help problem solve if problems are arising. It talks about the role of this kind of liaison function that could be reporting to county commissioners in an ongoing way. I mean, there are things that I think could have prevented a lot of problems if we just looked at it. And so I had a meeting with the one of the people at the division back then and asked, Why do we not do these parts that are here? You know, that looks like what the LME liaisons are supposed to be doing. And I was just told, that's not what my liaisons do. And I said, well, then who's doing it? And we really never developed that. So it's like, well, that was a different group of leadership and a different time, and I personally feel a lot more encouraged about the current set, I also feel like if language is strengthened and even maybe, yes, the very things that Senator Tucker is talking about happening, then nobody's really empowered to ensure a circle of accountability that involves counties, LME MCOs, and the state. And it's like, as long as that circle is unbroken, then when things don't happen or things happen the wrong way, we can point fingers at other folks. But I'm concerned. I want to be sure if they're looking at creating benchmarks and then looking at, okay, what does it look like when things are failing? I hope you have some consumers, either from the state CFAC or some other volunteer consumers that are helping you that understand at the community level what that looks like. And then the other thing is, how do we look at what's not happening in the community? Like, one reason we have so many hospitalizations is because some systems, some more than others, have not developed the services with the funds they've had to be really responsive to the community need. And so we may have too much of this service, but not enough of this kind of service, and then we end up with access problems and citizens default to going to the EDs. And this is happening during years even when a lot of money was sent, reverted to the state because it just didn't get drawn down and used in our LMEs. And this was all discussed on the commission, so I'm not just kind of coming up with this. But it's how do we be sure not only that we're using the money the right way, but how do we be sure that the systems are being developed responsibly enough to responsive to the communities that are serving, and how can we be sure that gets looked at too in whatever Dr. Melcher and what they're developing. Because there's some stuff that's not going to be in that hard data. It's not just about claims, as I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, let me do this because there's a lot there. Let me call on the department to respond to or maybe expound a little bit on what is different about the contracting process with the MCO, which is quite a bit different than the contracting under the LME structure. We'll probably need to get back on to the original question here that we had and see if we've got any particular comments on that, and we'll move forward. And also maybe respond to the question that was raised with respect to are there consumers involved in or have they been involved in terms of the working on the benchmarks? I realize some of those are financial, but as Dr. Gray was saying, a number of those benchmarks are things that you're following are outcomes and level of care. And the other thing I would mention, just very briefly, of course, a big part of the of going to the waiver is to try to address some of those service issues that you've raised. If the MCOs are not successful in doing that, then we really haven't achieved a major segment of what the move into the waiver environment was really all about. But Dr. Melcher?
In terms of the benchmarks, not at this point. We're pretty early in the process of that, but we will certainly, when we develop those, share those as well. In terms of outcomes, we have a fairly large initiative working with our waiver advisory committee around performance indicators, as well as a series of meetings across the state with families, consumers, stakeholders to get input and feedback from them in terms of the kinds of outcomes that they want to be seeing us not only collect, but put in a dashboard for public distribution.
Let me do this. Let me get back to the item that we had here, and as I say, that the proposal for this, for developing, rather than us develop in this subcommittee, the specifics parameters around which a county would disengage from an MCO, that we task the departments and the LMEs and the counties to come up with that procedure for doing that, and as an interim measure, that we would establish a 2-year moratorium, which could, you know, be dissolved at any time by the General Assembly. Hopefully in the report, let's say we would put a requirement in there that a report from that working group be presented to the General Assembly, say next March, a year from now, so that the General Assembly could act on in long session on anything that needed to be acted on specific to the disengagement of a county or group of counties, and then in that legislation you would sunset. Presumably, we would sunset the moratorium at that place because it would no longer be needed. And that would also, frankly, address. Really, we're addressing sort of item number two, barrier number two there, and barrier number three. Any particular comments or thoughts on that recommendation procedure, Mr. Botts?
I think from county's perspective, if you're a county that's participating in a large LME slash MCO, 15 county, 19 county, it's not the potential financial failure of the LME that the county is necessarily concerned about, although that can be a concern, and that is a concern of the state and everyone here. But for a particular county, the concern is, are the citizens of this county receiving the services they need? And the only way the county, once a county belongs to a large LME, a county can influence the LME by virtue of its board appointments, potentially. But other than that, there's not a lot a county can do if it's not satisfied with the services that its folks are receiving. I think from a county perspective, the ability to withdraw with a group of counties of a smaller LME to dissolve the LME is one of the things that counties feel like, well, that's just one of the limited ways we have a say, or to call attention to the LME they were not satisfied with what's going on. So I don't necessarily disagree with the problems identified here, or that these are barriers or potential problems. I just think that from a county perspective, if there's limited ways to get the attention of the LME and get the LME MCO to talk to the county when you feel that things are not going well, then to take away the ability to withdraw is, from a county government perspective, a little bit problematic, although I see why you want to control it. I would just point out a couple of other things. The 122C-115.3 currently says that a county, that's the statute that provides for a county to withdraw from an LME or a group of counties to dissolve an LME. It currently says that no county can withdraw from an LME and no group of counties can dissolve an LME without prior approval of the secretary. So statutes already require that the secretary approve it. Now, maybe the problem is there's no particular standard there, and maybe sometimes the problem is political. You know, maybe the secretary's office doesn't want to say no to a particular county. But that's a place to look, 122C-115.3B, the part that says that it requires withdrawal, requires secretary approval. So in addition to that comment, I just want to say that when we say that an LME MCO is an insurance plan or an insurance company, I think that's the kind of language that makes counties nervous, too, because an MCO under the capitated funding arrangement has an incentive to control costs. Costs are controlled by controlling access to services. So there is an incentive to control, potentially, to control services and control access to services by underutilizing services, by using utilization management as a means to, out of concerns for financial considerations, to underutilize services. So there are going to be, and there have been, you know, county departments of social services that are concerned that their families that need services may not get services because services are being underutilized through MCO mechanisms. So again, if that's what they're feeling, short of doing a Medicaid appeal through OAH, which is costly, and there are social services departments and LMEs who have fought all the way to OAH and then to Superior Court, what is a county's recourse? You know, board appointments, board composition. If there was some mechanism in the statutes, I don't want to make things complicated, but if there's some way for a county that's dissatisfied to get the attention of an LME about how it's doing utilization management, short of withdrawing or short of doing a Medicaid appeal, then I think counties might feel easier about, you know, having limits on their ability to withdraw. I'm just throwing it out there. I think Rebecca Troutman can probably say more about that than me. The other thing I just say, yeah, they are insurance plans, but they're also LMEs. There's nothing quasi-public about an LME doing an MCO. It's fully public. I think, again, people from county government perspective, when they hear quasi-public, and LMEs will use those terms too, That makes them nervous because then it raises questions. Well, do the public records law, open records law, open meetings, and other kinds of laws that apply to local governments, generally do they apply to LMEs? So I understand why we're saying the words quasi and insurance plan, but I just don't want the public to be misled. An LME that operates an MCO is more than an insurance plan or health benefit plan. It is that, but it is also a fully public entity with additional duties because it is an LME. That would not be the case if the state was contracting with some outside private organization to do MCO. So I know I said a lot and put a lot on the table, but I just thought that was important to say.
Just a couple observations in terms of some of the things you were bringing up there, and I'll call on anybody who wants to respond. But the because of the nature of it, I think that's the reason why we have a more spelled out, at least in the tentative proposal that we've got on the governance, is we have spelled out participation in the boards, in all of these boards, for a consumer voice, so that that voice is there, and it's more than just one person on that group. And we do, I think, I don't think anyone's suggesting, or at least not that I've heard, that counties should be prevented from being able to continue to exercise an ability to withdraw. And I think the things that you pointed out there for, you know, sometimes just being able to have that leverage out there is something that people want to maintain, and I can appreciate that. I think the concern is that with the complexity of the MCO, and the fact that the MCO is at risk, although in many respects really the state is ultimately at risk, because the counties are no longer at risk. Now that is different as well. The counties are no longer at risk. The state's at risk. And obviously we're very concerned from the state's perspective. But I don't think anybody wants to keep the counties from withdrawing, but I think that the concern is the rationale for having a moratorium would be to give the department and the counties and the LME MCOs time to bring forward a detailed proposal about how that would operate. In other words, how the state would handle its part, how we would make sure that with that if that disengagement comes, that it doesn't unduly burden the financial structure, or how we would deal with that, how we deal with the financial structure of the remaining MCO. I mean, particularly if it's more than one county that's saying, hey, you know, we're not happy, we want to do something different. We need to be able to have mechanisms in place to be able to deal with that financially, and safeguards in place to make sure that we would not have any undue disruption to the services and how they would be provided, either in the group of counties remaining or in the group of counties leaving. And also, I think that, you know, you've got to deal with the, you know, we have certain and I'm sure you, obviously you know this, but you know the population limitations there. What if this put one of the other groups underneath the population threshold? We've got to be able to make sure that we understand exactly how we would address that. So I think there are a lot of just detail things that have to be. I don't think there are things that can't be agreed to so much as just the details of it being able to be worked out. And in this very critical time when people are transitioning to the MCOs, in which there are lots of concerns and lots of things that they have to work through, you know, don't have somebody just bailing out. I mean, you're sitting there trying to put together an MCO, and then somebody says, oh, this is too hard. Or they may have legitimate concerns. I'm not saying that, but they may say, "We want to bail on you," and that's not the time they need to bail. That's the time that people need to get together and say, "Hey, look, we're in this boat together, and we've got to make this boat, you know, seaworthy as we're moving toward the objective." But at any rate, I've talked too long, and I apologize for that. But Yeah, I see a couple of hands.
I just want to see. I totally agree with everything you said. I think a moratorium makes sense. It's destabilizing for counties to too often think about withdrawing or dissolving and to do it willy-nilly. I think the secretary has full authority to deny, to not approve such a thing. You know, my point is, and I think, I think practically it becomes difficult given the population thresholds and the fact that if you withdraw, you got to find someone to partner with, and there may not be someone to partner with. So I agree with everything said. I just think that really counties, they're more concerned about their citizens receiving sufficient services than they are about having the ability to withdraw or to join another one. So that's all I wanted to say.
Commissioner Kruth.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think that's why I think in this, to add to that, it isn't the process. It's got to be the thing. It's where the devil, I guess the devil's in the details, because, you know, I see similar to what you have happening with the COG structure across the state, that if a county or a city wants to pull out, terminate their membership with a COG, normally they have to notify the COG 12 months before that membership actually terminates. And what that would give, two things. One of them is it would give a chance for then the department and the LME or MCO then also jump in there, identify, well, what are the real issues here? Can they be resolved in that 12-month period? But the other thing is it gives a chance then to gently change the finances and move that to another one, address the issue of if that LME now is now going to be below the threshold and all those things before, you know, the execute date. Because if you have it so that they can just move and decide in their budget deliberations in May and June, we're going to terminate our membership in this LME and we're going to leave, then it's going to create chaos.
Well, what would be, just to follow up on that, what would be your view of saying that we would put forward a moratorium with regard to LMEs that are moving to MCOs, a moratorium of, I'm saying 2 years, year, 2 years, during this transition time in which people could not withdraw, not disengage, while the groups are working out the process? Obviously, like you say, with the COGS, you have a work, there's a procedure there. There's not a detailed procedure here that I can discern beyond the basic statutory language. I don't think we have a detailed plan in place for how that would and how you would address the components of that. Would you support a, I guess I'm putting you on the spot, I guess, but I was trying to get your reaction to some type of moratorium while we get that piece of it worked out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when I put a limit to it, it will force that discussion to take place. But I think that, yeah, that's something I don't think that we can sit here and put the details of that together here in this room with this subcommittee. I think it's going to take some folks with much more letters after their name than I do or anybody to figure that out and come up with the detailed process about how that would occur. But by saying, no, we're not going to have it because it's too hard, I think that sells it short. The county's giving them that freedom, but I think on the other side, you've got to have something to protect the stability of the system.
Thank you. Ms. Copeland.
Thank you, Chairman Dollar. The council would definitely support a moratorium. It's not something we had thought about, but I think it fits in a number of ways. One, it provides the stability that we need while we make this transition. Two, it takes advantage of our current position with the counties. Right now, counties have, by consensus, formed these relationships, and they are three-year commitments, so it falls within that three-year time period, so that's consistent, as well as it provides us with the ample time to work together to explore and address all of the implications associated with a county withdrawal, which we're really not certain of. So we really appreciate this solution and support it fully.
Ms. Shipman.
Thank you. And I wanted to say, too, it takes a while for a community system to understand how a waiver works, you know, and, you know, it take, you know, we certainly started ours during the early years of system reform, you know, and that, you know, was also a complicating factor. But nevertheless, it does take a while, you know, for all the local agencies to understand and, you know, not to really think about, you know, one case versus total penetration. And penetration and access is something that, you know, is very carefully monitored as part of waiver accountability. This is something that's very easy for DMA and the actuaries to look at your penetration prior to going on the waiver and penetration afterwards, and it's certainly something they look at, you know. And the last thing to say is, you know, the capitation rates, our experience is that they are set in line with service expectations. You know, it's not that the rates drove utilization down in the PBH catchment. It's the other way around. The utilization went down and the rates followed. And in our experience in receiving rates for our new areas that we're working with, you know, the rates in the PBH counties are $100 per member per month less than one of the new areas that's coming with PBH. And so the rates are not set in order to force, you know, drastic changes in the system. You know, they're really very set according to prior expenditures and utilization with some, you know, goals. And so I don't think that we should worry that counties or population groups are going to experience these horrendous, you know, changes in utilization, because I don't think that's the intent, and that certainly hasn't been our experience.
Ms. Weaver.
Thank you, Chairman Dollar. I think the rural counties are the ones that are most at risk, because it's hard enough to get people to serve in the rural counties as far as providers, and now you're closing a network. And I think they're the counties that are the most concerned about whether or not they have any say-so and where they go. In fact, my county, and maybe this is just because of our hillbilly roots, actually asked me if it was feasible for us to take our share of the capitation rate and run our own program. So I think everybody made good points, but I just wanted to throw that in, that the rural counties do have different concerns.
Other comments on that, on 2 and 3? If not, Ms. Coker.
I had wondered about the possibility of having language in the statute that gives a little bit more strength and power to the county's role, that might have the county commissioner, either the full commissioner boards or a portion of them, certainly to include what county commissioners are on the MCO boards, but to have them meeting either, you know, every 6 months or every 12 months, whatever, to discuss the status among themselves, because that would increase some cohesion among the counties to problem solve and address issues in a more timely way, because they're getting each other's perspectives on what their citizens are experiencing. But also, if these meetings had the CFAC members and board members there, I think one thing that's been missing a lot of times is that in our community, we've tried to get the county commissioners and our LME board together multiple times, and we just can't do it, which leaves them excusing whatever problems are there and blaming them on the other party. Well, we're the ones at risk. You know, we need for people to be working together for our benefit, and I just think that the lateral communication among the counties is just going to strengthen their role together, and it gives an open opportunity for counties to hear from the CFAC members that come from their constituents, and for the board to be hearing all this in an open forum, and then if there are advocates or whatever that really want to come. But I think there are too many little disconnects that are still going to be there the way our statute's currently written. And and like Mr. Botts was saying, that the counties really have some pretty limited authority. And if we want to really have this be a public system, it needs to be much more informed, you know, up and down and sideways by people who actually are experiencing how the system's working. Anyway, that's just an idea. Thanks.
Thank you. The if I only have any other comments on 2 and 3, let's move to item 4 here. And I think this is a point. Our single county LME representative was at a budget meeting down. In fact, I saw him on the street. Didn't get it. I was too far away to wave. But he was going into a budget meeting with a Wake County commissioner. So your thoughts and prayers should be with him this time of need. But I think that, and somebody please correct me or update me, that what was being looked at here for those that are single county LMEs currently that are a department of the county, that the language that is currently in the statute that creates a conflict with the MCO model would simply be taken out of the statute. And was there any concerns about doing that, or any considerations that anybody wants to make comment about? Mr. Botts.
What is the I see the problem. What is the proposed remedy to that? I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying, the statutory remedy.
I think the proposed remedy, and I may have to call on Dr. Porter here if I don't get it right, is to simply remove the language that is there that conflicts with them being able to operate as an MCO model. So the particular statutory provision is I can't cite you at the moment, but Dr. Porter, am I right on that, or Doctor, let me, because you're a doctor too, aren't you?
No, I've got a JD, but if you want to call me doctor, it's a juris doctor. You know?
Dr. Botts.
Whatever will elevate my status among this group.
Nelson, he's a lawyer. Let him go.
It couldn't be any higher than it already is.
I don't know. I think I'm climbing. I need to climb my way back up.
No.
I believe it's 122C-116 that says... a single county area authority is considered a department of the county for purposes of budget and fiscal control. Were you talking about eliminating the language that says it's considered a department of the county for purposes of GS-159, or were you planning on just eliminating the possibility to have a single county area authority?
Oh, that it's a department of the county.
Okay. Which would then mean it would have independent... responsibility and authority to adopt its own budget and do its own fiscal control like a multi-county area authority? Is that what's being suggested?
Yes. Okay. And if that's not everybody's understanding on that, Ms. Troutman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to confirm that, in fact, what would be taken out is for the purposes of Chapter 159 of the General Statutes. Was that direct tie-in to the Fiscal Budget and Control Act? But not that they could not be a single county department, only within terms to the Chapter 159.
But not be a department of the
county.
I think that's what 159
is.
Mr. Botts.
Well, I mean, there's two. The statute currently, if we're talking about amending 122C-116, which says a single county area authority is considered a department of the county for purposes of, and it may say GS-159 or it may say a budget and fiscal control. If you say that it's not, if you strike that language, then it would presumably still have to follow 159. I say presumably because I'm just thinking through this, but all local governmental entities have to follow GS-159, the Budget and Fiscal Control Act. If you strike the language that says it's considered a department of the county for that purpose, that means instead of now, as of now, they have to go through the county budget and financial management, through the county budget office or county finance office. that if you just said, if you strike the language saying it's considered a department of the county for purposes of 159, then it would be, still have to follow 159, but it would be independent. It would be like a multi-county area authority. They would have to appoint their own budget officer, not use the county budget officer, appoint their own finance officer, not use the county finance officer. The budget officer and the finance officers would then follow the same duties that are outlined in 159 for them as are outlined for multi-county area authority budget and finance officers. And the area board would be the entity that adopts the budget ordinance. Is that what you're talking about? Okay.
And is that, Ms. Troutman, that's your understanding as well, correct?
It is. I would just want to make sure that, in fact, Mecklenburg County has been consulted with about this, because I know this is an exact impact on their statutory authority, and that would be my only caution.
Well, what we could do is the specific statutory language is drafted by staff, we can make sure that we're in touch with Mecklenburg County to ensure that we're clear about that and that we're fixing because I think if I'm hearing correctly, we're agreed on what needs to be done. We just need to make sure that we're doing it in the appropriate way.
Whether or not it affects Mecklenburg County depends on what Mecklenburg County thinks it is or says it is or is in fact. And that's, are they a single county area authority or are they a consolidated human service agency? If they're a consolidated human service agency, which one of their board resolutions says, then this would not impact them. So, but that can be figured out and worked out.
Right, we'll get the staff to get a clarification on that with Mecklenburg County. Great point.
And then I just say only, besides Mecklenburg, the only other, Johnston County and Cumberland County are single county area authorities. That are entering into an interlocal agreement with Durham/Wake, but I think those are the only three counties that would be impacted.
Right. Okay, so I think everyone's agreed upon that. It's just a matter of making sure that we'll consult with, make sure that Mecklenburg County is consulted with in particular, and make sure that we're adjusting the appropriate parts of the statute to get the effect that we want and avoid an effect that would otherwise not be intended. There is under the next bullet point, 122C holds counties responsible for the provision of these services, I guess mental health services. However, counties do not have the resources to carry out these requirements. As you see there, it should be in your, I think on the second, maybe it's on the first or second page of, probably the first page, I guess, of what you, bottom of the first page there. The staff has recommended a statutory change to clarify that the counties are not wholly still responsible for carrying out those duties, since the responsibility is the MCO is what's at risk and the state is essentially what's at risk. We can look at this language. This language is language that staff has come up with on that point, and would entertain any thoughts on that. Troutman.
Yes, if I could just have a staff explanation of kind of the implications of this new language, that would be very helpful to me.
Mr. Parker.
What the new language attempts to do is that actually it's a modifier. It does not say that county is no longer responsible for providing the mental health, but as it relates to House Bill 916, where counties were given leave of fiscal responsibility in case of failure. So what was requested was that they maintain the responsibilities, but then it's qualified by what they must do under the restructuring of the management. So therefore, basically says that the county shall provide mental health, DD, and substance abuse services through an area authority in accordance with any rules, policies, guidelines adopted pursuant to the restructuring of management responsibilities. So again, it ties in what was, I guess, in House Bill 916 as far as the responsibilities of counties with what is currently in statute.
So we're just, what we're wanting to do is to clarify that for the counties. And I think it's fairly straightforward and clear language.
Well, that's how I read it, was basically to tie in House Bill 916 back to 122C.
Right, exactly. Any other comments on that? Okay, let's take a we've gone through those items. Let's take a 5-minute break to the bottom of the hour. And then we'll reconvene at 3:30. So again, we have restrooms in the back. There's coffee that's not too old over here, and restrooms around the backside of the room. I believe Senator Tucker has, before I get started, Senator Tucker has something he wants to share.
Mr. Dollar, or Chairman, I want to do something that politicians don't normally do. They admit when they make a mistake, and I owe Mr. Jordan an apology. He was correct. It did not exist. I should have had my facts straight. I still say he should have called me and told me before I stuck my foot in my mouth. But at any rate, he was correct, and we've straightened that issue out, and he has responded promptly. Thank you, sir.
I am pleased to see that it has been worked out between the legislative branch and the executive branch. That's always
good. Is that a first around here?
It's not far from a second. Okay. All right. What I would like to do, we've moved fairly well so far, and hopefully the second half today will be expeditious as well. We will hand this out and may be able to take it some of this up today or not. What I want to do, I want to go back and since you've had a chance to have these recommendations for the governing board, I want to have some additional discussion on that. And depending on when we can get finished with that, hopefully, maybe we can get finished with it rather quickly, maybe not. The next barrier that we need to take a look at, and it has two or three parts to it, are the powers of the LME-MCO. So at the very least, we'll be sure before the end of the meeting to pass out a paper with some of those barriers / considerations, a synopsis of those, that if we are not able to take it up, at least begin to take it up in this meeting, we can take it up at our next meeting in April. And these are things that were with your original documents, but you may not you know, still have those handy. We'll get those in your hands. But the powers of the MCO, LME MCO, that's kind of the next thing for us to take up. But before we get to that, we do want to go back to the first two-pager that we handed out initially in terms of recommendations for the governing board, and see if you have any additional comments or clarifications. I think I'll go ahead and start and do this just to make sure it's clear on the second page where it says Model 1 revised under those two check marks. I want to be clear what we're saying there, or try to be clear. Either one of these options essentially maintains Model 1, the current model that we had talked about in prior meetings with county commissioners making those appointments, with the added provisions that we have set forward in terms of size, terms, training, attendance, board composition, and the like. And then under that second check mark, by a two-thirds majority of the county commissioners, two-thirds majority of the boards of the county commissioners, they could choose to adopt a different mechanism for doing that, and that would be fine for them to do that, as long, again, as they included stayed within the parameters that we're setting forth in terms of size, terms, training, attendance, and board composition in terms of the minimum standards with regard to the folks that would be the expertise and the consumer representation that would be on there. And that would allow for some of the newer creative things that folks had talked about to proceed. Obviously, it would mean a change for some of the others because their structure is such that you don't have the representation that we had identified as being so critical to the process in our prior meetings. So, anyway, with that said, I'll entertain some reaction, commentary, helpful suggestions. Ms. Copeland.
I just have a question about the change that you just referenced for those who would have to change their structure. How long do you see that taking in terms of a transition period, and when would this be effective?
Well, I think that's something that we would need to work out probably based on where the LME MCO would be in process, because, as you know, we've got the schedule, and some folks that are essentially changed over now, I'm sure that we could provide some type of we'd have to provide some sort of period of time for certain people to be able to get adjusted to that. And that would seems to me, a reasonable thing to make sure that we put into the statute, the effective language. Mr. Hedrick.
Chairman Dollar, I have a suggestion for the board composition as handed out today, if now would be the appropriate time to mention that.
Yes, sir.
In earlier discussions about this issue, we had NC Providers Council and other providers thought that there should be a provider serving at least in an ex officio capacity on the boards. The president or his or her designee of the MCO Provider Network Council serving in an ex officio capacity. We think their knowledge, fiscal management, budget management, fiscal accountability, and LME knowledge, LME function knowledge is critical, and that they should be added in an ex officio capacity.
Would that be, in your thought on that, would that be, when you say ex officio, of course, I think Dr. Botts in this case. Dr. Botts had informed us of ex officio can mean some different things and some different, maybe different from the common view of it. But for our purposes, you would be meaning non-voting, correct? In other words, you would be saying ex officio slash non-voting member.
Yes,
of
sir.
That.
With voice, but not with vote.
Now, it's my understanding, because I know part of the consideration of that was, I think there were some questions out there with respect to if that was an allowable option. And I've been hearing from the staff's research that I think the only barrier to being able to do that would be there's a state statute that might need to be modified. But I think the bigger concern was from the federal perspective, obviously. And I'd like to have Dr. Gray comment on this. It's my understanding that, Dr. Gray, just let me let you comment on that. Would there be any prohibition?
Representative Dollar, thank you. That there would be no prohibition to a provider attending and speaking at a forum. They cannot be a provider and receiving benefits of the Medicaid program and vote in that forum. So it would be okay.
All right. Mr. Simmons.
So a provider could attend in an ex officio capacity. I mean, the issue we're dealing with that needs to be addressed at the board meetings is the impact the policy has on providers. There's not an adequate voice at the boards. Give us an opportunity to at least explain to the members of the board the impact of certain decisions and strategies that are implemented in the provision of services, MHT, DSA services, and the impact they'll have on consumers as well as providers. So I understood that there may be a state statute that would need to be changed, but that's just in a brief conversation here today. So,
Ms. Riddle.
So appreciate the complexities, I said last time, of the board composition, but I would like to continue to advocate for there to be a minimum of six individuals and family members on these boards, with two from each of the constituent groups. I just feel very strongly that we have affirmed to the community that these are public boards, and that it is just terribly important that the public that is being served be represented robustly on the board. I realize that that would take the board size from some or closer up to somewhere between 18 and 25. I realize that is not ideal. At the same time, I feel it's important that we genuinely reflect the participation of the individuals we serve. With regard to the developmental disabilities community, I would urge that were we so fortunate as to get that sort of representation, that we look at one of those individuals being a person with a disability, with a developmental disability, and one of those individuals being a family member. I would not make an effort to speak on behalf of the mental health and substance abuse community. I spent some time this morning talking with the state's Developmental Disabilities Consortium. I think there's a pretty strong sentiment in there that the structure that gives the most adequate representation to individuals and to their families is Model 2. And I would lastly, continue to encourage us, although I don't see this appearing in statute, Mr. Botts, that we do make sure that training for these boards is ongoing, accessible, and independent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And It on the proposal here with regard to training, it does say annual, so it would. I think that would be the definite intent would be to have annual training.
Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. I know your name, and I can't remember to save my life.
Norman.
Correct. I'm in agreement with the composition of the board. However, I'm a little concerned about that if it's going to say at least one of each of the following, that even in my area in Wilmington, I might have some difficulty in finding someone who has insurance expertise and who is an attorney with health care experience that might want to serve on our area board. And so if I can't find those individuals, then would I be out of compliance with statute? So I guess I would suggest, is there some way to have some flexibility for there to be some substitutes?
We could take a look at that. I think we could find that expertise, though. I guess maybe I may be thinking differently on a different wavelength, but we could certainly look at that. Ms. Coker.
I just wanted to add on to what Ms. Riddle has recommended. I think one of the concerns I've wondered about, too, is as far as consumers participating. Consumer Family Advisory Committees, they vary from community to community, and all that, a lot of that has to do with the leadership at the very top of the LME, but some of them, you know, are working hard during the day, and they go to their meetings, and the biggest information source they have are just the reports they're getting from inside the LME. They don't have, sometimes they don't have enough of an ear to the community and what's really being experienced by other people in the community. So I think that it would be more informative to the board to have these CFAC member voices, but also a second voice for each of the disabilities that's not actually a CFAC member, so that you're ensuring that there's some external input too. I know, I'm sorry if that reflects a lack of trust, you know, in the system, but you can have a totally different impression on the inside from what's going on the outside sometimes in these.
Well, let me ask a clarifying question for me along that line, and I'm not sure who the best person is to answer this. It's my understanding that if you are parent, guardian, family member, or person with a disability, you can join. There's not a barrier to you joining and being part of the CFAC organization. Isn't that correct? Well, if you don't mind, Mr. Jordan, if you were shaking your head, yes. What's the composition of the CFAC is sort of a voluntary organization, correct? If you want to join it, you can join it. Assuming you have a disability, you're caring for someone with a disability or mental disease, what have you.
So, Senator, Representative, yes, you are correct that you can be a part of the CFAC and be a part of the overall group, and they have their own governing structure at the local level. And then there's the statewide CFAC that we have. But, yes, parents and individuals receiving services do have the opportunity to be a part of the CFAC.
And I'll get to you, Ms. Reed, in just a moment, but it's my understanding that part of the effort that is ongoing is, or as part of this, has been to work to strengthen the CFAC organization. Is that not correct? I see Ms. Copeland shaking her head, yes.
And I will say that before Holly brought up the issue of the numbers, I feel like that we would have to strengthen the CFACs because, as Ms. Weaver can probably tell you, there's so much variability in how they behave, what their role is with their LMEs. A lot of them aren't as assertive of input. They just have a role of kind of approving what gets put in front of them. And then in some communities, advocates who may be more vocal or just kind of more knowledgeable, they drop off pretty quickly because they feel like there's
it's kind of agenda guided, and they don't feel like it's a real free place to quite give input. So I guess I'm just saying that sometimes the CPAC may not be able to have as broad a community perspective as we'd like. And certainly that's not in all communities. There are some communities whose CFACs feel quite comfortable. One of the board members on our organization is real excited about how her CFAC interacts with the board and with the leadership staff and the changes that have come. But then there are other places where it's not been much that way at all. So,
well, I think one of the things, in this structure, what you would have that you don't have now, I mean, you don't necessarily, and Mr. Parker can correct me on this, you don't necessarily have an assurance that you have someone from the consumer side on the current LME board. And what this would be doing, it seems to me, would be going a long way, because you would say, okay, we're going to have CFAC membership, we're going to at least have a voice from each of those three major communities. I mean, obviously there's a lot of things going on underneath those major communities, but you would have those three. They would be on the board. You don't have that now. And it would be tied to the CFAC for the whole purpose of helping to strengthen the coordination and working together of the consumers from the various perspectives. And I would think if there was a CFAC out there that was not very strong, this would certainly encourage them for people to want to participate and to work with that organization, knowing that they had actual representation on that MCO board. Ms. Weaver.
Before I get to my actual question, I'm going to comment on what you're discussing now. As the current chair of the state CFAC and having been on my local CFAC since 2005, I just would like to point out that in the statute, the CFACs at the local level and the state CFAC are self-governing and self-directed, which accounts for the big difference from one to the other. And then if I could go on to my question, last time we got three models, you know, one, two, and three, and this time we only have one. Last time we talked about probably coming to a consensus, something between model two and three, and today I see we have model one revised. How did we get there?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is we're taking in all of the input that's come in and trying to come to trying to focus it in. And there was quite a different view of the different models. I would point out that, you know, the element of having in Model 2, which was, I think, a third, and a third was the commentary on that. Well, you have the essence of that in terms of you have the consumer community represented. You have the specialties that were discussed as being very important to the operation of an MCO in terms of insurance, finance, legal, those things. And then, of course, you have the county commissioners there, and they're appointing. And of course, we in all those models, we talked about making sure that we had a local appointment from the from HHS. The third model, which was based off of PBH, would be would fall into to this structure by virtue of the second checked area, I guess, on the second page, where they could, by two-thirds vote of the boards of commissioners, they could adopt a little different structured model in terms of how they were pointing and how they were putting that together, so long as they had the minimum expertise, consumer representation on there. The things like, for example, board training and attendance and terms and the like I think we're pretty well, I think most everybody was in pretty good consensus along that line. So I think that what you have in the two options down there, and maybe Model 1 is the wrong way to title it, but in the two options that LME MCO would have, or the counties really, would have the ability to choose between, you've got the elements of all three models to one extent or another incorporated in there. That's the intent of pulling that together, to give flexibility, but also to make sure that we took into account a number of the specific things that were recommended.
Well, that's what scares me a little bit about this, is when Mr. Botts explained to us at our first meeting that the current statute gives two choices, the second choice being, you know, do whatever you want as long as everybody agrees. And that's how we ended up with one LME that it's made up of county managers. And I just don't want to see that happen again.
Well, and that's a great point. And to that point, under this structure, that would not be allowed to happen. That they would have to transition, and I think that's part of a question that was raised earlier about transition time from some folks that are set up with a structure that would not work under this proposal, and that we would provide, I guess, some not too long period of time, but some reasonable period of time to make that transition. Ms. Riddle?
Going back to the point that the CFACs are self-governing, I think that is why those of us in the Developmental Disabilities Consortium really did like the idea that the CFACs themselves might nominate one-third. If that idea is not going to make it, I think my default position would be that the CFACs make recommendations to the county commissioners rather than the county commissioners just going in and saying you and you. At least in that way, you preserve, you know, the representation by individuals on the CFAC of their interest.
Okay, let me make sure, because I may not be understanding you, Ms. Riddle. The because I think under the first one there, it would be the chair or the chair's designee. So that would address, for that one slot, that would address what you're talking about, right?
Correct.
And then for the other two, what you're saying is you would want those to be nominated as, it would be the
correct
county commissioners making the appointment, but if I'm understanding, what you're saying is they would be nominated by the CFAC as opposed to the commissioners deciding within the CFAC who that is.
Yes, sir. That's how Council on Developmental Disabilities works. We nominate a slate of members to the governor, and the governor chooses from that slate of members. We usually give the governor an alternative or two, but I think when you have a CFAC or a council that's respected, then the appointing authority probably leans in the direction of the nominating group.
Well, that's how we fill vacancies around here as well. So, familiar with that process. Mr. Curry.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a couple of comments about, I'm listening to it and coming at it from 12 years' experience on the PBH board as well as commissioner, is that, you know, one of the very reasons the reason we're sitting here today is because about 8 years ago, the area director at the time, Dan Coughlin, came to the board at PBH and approached us about going to the state and asking for a waiver. And we've seen how successful that's been, and by the fact that now we're trying to do it across the state. And I was thinking about just brainstorming, and of course, Ms. Shipman may be able to add more to it, but I just kind of jotted down what I thought were things that made it successful. And a lot of that is the fact that the counties appointed the members of the board and got out of the way. The board then developed the Carver governance model and were trained on it. And so we built a fence, put the area director inside that fence, and gave him the freedom to do what he needed to do to hire the expertise and have the expertise. We had also got heavily involved, have been very active and involved, have been our CFAC and the provider councils to advise the board of directors on what we needed to do. And before you think that our board of directors has just sat there, our governing board has been very monolithic and just sat there and not done anything. If Shipman can attest that we've had some pretty good knock 'em down, drag 'em outs on our board of directors over the past several years. But I think that, you know, one side we've got, we're doing the waiver where we're freeing up the money, we're tearing down the silos, we're giving it to the MCOs to manage it the best way they know how to manage it. But the more on the other side we build up and get specific down to the, you know, the more specific we're going to get, the less likely it is to be successful, because we're just putting back in the restrictions just in another way on that by how we do things. And that's the reason I would say is, even, you know, it'd be great for us to get all these people on there, but if we say it in law that we have to have these people represented, rather than saying the people that are appointed need to have these, you know, it's just guidelines for, that they need to have some kind of background in these areas. It may just be subtle, but what it does, I think, is it gives us still the freedom. So there's people that will have, you say if you're a commissioner, then you can't, if you're a commissioner, but you're also a family member, a consumer, or a consumer yourself, does that meet the requirement? You know, and then, of course, what percentage are we going to say commissioners have to make up the board? Because you could have a smaller board where you could land up with one commissioner from seven or eight counties. How do you handle that? I mean, that's so you've got to have, I think, that balance has got to be struck, and you've got to do it in such a way so that you may look for people with two or three that meet two or three of these criteria in one person. And therefore, you don't have to have an individual representing each one of these. You might have one person that represents, you know, two or three of these on that board. So, but it gives the flexibility with guidelines, just like you would on any other board, where you would maybe even have the questionnaire as part of the application process. You would identify that you have expertise and even assign points so that you get the strongest people that fulfill the most role, could fill one or, you know, two or more roles on the board, especially the smaller boards. So I don't know if I really said anything or not, but...
Mr. Cochran.
Thank you, sir. I was just quickly to emphasize what Ms. Riddle said earlier about their board training, that I think many of us, or I particularly feel that should be independent. It's okay to have a curriculum, but part of teaching a board is really having a board hear what's best practice, and that does change over time, and also just being independent of that. The other part is, I guess, if the clarifying language, for example, under the CFAC, would make it clear, for example, it says in there, if you must end up with a representative from each of the three major disability groups, is there maybe clarifying language, for example, you could actually have five people under that category. For example, if your chairman happened to have come from someone, family member of someone with DD, and you have a DD a consumer, then you could end up with a family member who's from DD, so you'd have to add two more people from your at-large slots. So I think if there's language in here saying you've got to have 11, but you also can have an additional five at-large slots, so that those at-large slots could be used to round that out. So you could, in effect, have more people sitting there, and that may help with that process of getting closer to one-third, one-third. The other one is, and I was trying to follow you, sir, but I'm not sure I got it, but also going to what Mr. Norman said, is perhaps it's some of the language a little bit broader in saying, you know, rather than specifically an attorney, or some of these are saying someone who has an extensive experience in the legal or the day-to-day operation, et cetera, that, so that if he can't find an attorney willing to do that in Wilmington or that area, then there's broad enough to be able to cover that slot with someone who has had extensive experiences as an exec or, you know, functioning away. And I don't know if there's other terms than that other than just referring to attorneys or as doctors. Thank you.
I can't imagine there'd be a shortage of attorneys. I've been in some of the smallest counties in the state. I've never found a shortage of attorneys, but maybe that's the case in some way. Let me bounce over here real quick. Senator Hartzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first, I want to apologize for having missed the last meeting and the first half of this meeting. And I think I probably missed something fairly significant in the course of it. And in so doing, I hope I'm not upsetting the apple cart too much by a couple of comments, if I might make them. I think there's a model that we're missing here, and that is the model that exists with regard to public health authorities and or hospital authorities. I think you could utilize that mechanism over a regional basis fairly easily and create these kinds of situations, because remember, we're creating a what is in effect a public franchise for providing certain kinds of services, which is in fact, it's almost like having creating a monopoly of risk pools. It is highly dependent on the leadership, and I mean the administrative leadership, of the individual entities that are established and the mechanics of what they set up. And I would suggest that it would be very useful to look at the mechanisms associated with hospital authorities and or public health authorities, because they identify powers, duties, boards, that I mean the strengths and the numbers and that sort of thing. The question then becomes, how do you, I mean, who appoints them? I would say that if you're talking about a region, and with all due respect to my friend Bob Carruth, who is a county commissioner in my home county, and to the county commissioners as a whole, if you're talking about a region, I'm not sure it's useful. It's hard enough to get county commissioners within one county to agree on something, much less county commissioners in multiple counties to agree on something or someone in many circumstances. At least that's been my observation and experience, which I had for 20 years as a county attorney. But beyond that, I think that it, I think it's appropriate to have a commissioner associated with the entity to be a party and to be appointed, or maybe more than one. But I'm not sure that you'll have a whole lot of success in getting multiple counties to agree. I think that that appointment should come from perhaps a pool of folks from a state level and to begin with. But what I'm saying is, I think we need to look at the other models. I think we need to, we probably have, in all candor for success, I think there are 11 LMEs that are now contemplated. I think that's probably too many. In the long run, I think that quite honestly, in the structure we're talking about, I think it is impractical to look at this from kind of narrowing 112, the current statute. I think we're going to have to create something new for these kinds of entities that is a merger of them all, and in some fashion. And I would also suggest that, I mean, in terms of the board composition, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the nature of the board, what you're identifying here, is useful and is appropriate. It's a matter of how many of those, and you may have to be flexible in the context of depending on the region and who points and that sort of thing. But finally, I would say that an attorney with healthcare experience is probably unnecessary on such a board, and I say that because any public board will have its own attorney anyway. If it doesn't, it should have. And I would assume that a board would select someone who has some experience in that regard. That's not to say you wouldn't appoint an attorney or shouldn't be eligible or not eligible or whatever, but I'm not sure that it is necessary that you have someone who is an attorney actually serving on the board. You might end up in some ways, for even for that member, creating a conflict. I'm not sure that would happen, but it could happen depending on some circumstances.
Thank you, Senator Hartzell. I think there is the thought that whether it's this committee or a successor committee, stakeholder group, will be looking at additional issues in 122C or other parts of the statute, following the short session and forward, might look at some of those broader issues and that you're talking about in terms of some of those different models. Essentially, our task from the our charge, rather, from the oversight committee was to focus in. Major issues here, obviously, but focus in on those things that we've identified as major barriers to having a successful transition currently, and certainly addressing the governance issue. And I think that, and this, I think, along the lines of some of the things you're saying, but obviously what we're trying to do is we're trying to balance, we're trying to create a board that balances the interest, where you have the longstanding involvement with the counties, and we don't want to take that away, and we want to keep that, maintain that. We also know that this is a very different financial animal. It's a very different, and animal's not the right word. It is a very different financial structure. The LMEs that are converting right now to MCOs are adding tremendous staffs. And in fact, there's been a lot of public commentary. You know, what are these people adding 100 more people? Well, they're adding 100 more people because that's what it's going to take to be able to operate. They're going to be it's going to be very different in terms of claims. It's going to be very different in terms and some of the LME MCO people might want to comment on this, but I know that it's going to be a very, very different set of parameters under which they are operating, which was the drive behind, particularly from the state's perspective, frankly, since the state's in this model is ultimately at risk. We've sort of taken the risk back to the state from the counties, and in consideration of that, we want to make sure that we have the appropriate expertise on the board to the extent that we can. And I think in the transition to the waivers, obviously the consumers and families have expressed concerns. They've expressed concerns under the old structure. They expressed concerns in terms of the waiver structure. And what we've wanted to do is to balance that concern to ensure that there is representation on there for consumers on these LME MCOs. And we've got to, of course, I know you agree with this, we've got to do everything we can reasonably do and foresee to make sure these things are successful and that they operate things or not things. These structures are successful for the appropriate provision of mental health services, disability services, and substance abuse services. But there was a part of your question there that I wanted to get, if Ms. Shipman doesn't mind responding to it. The model that PBH has been pursuing in terms of governance, and this gets at part of what you're, I think part of what you're saying, Senator Hartzell, and you've added the three additional LMEs to PBH, and you've come up with a methodology to balance those in creating your board, and if, unless I'm sorely mistaken, you could operate that structure under what we have laid out in the parameters here.
Yes, if we can get all of our counties to, or 66% maybe, to agree, and we are taking it around to the counties now. I think, what Fletcher is talking about is the more the public authority model in terms of being a better match for the new responsibilities of the MCOs, when compared to 2022C, which is, quite old. So, I would absolutely agree with, what he's saying is, best of all worlds, yes, absolutely, the public authority model that the hospitals use and Cabarrus Authority uses is a better model.
Ms. Riddle.
I noticed that under your terms, you have three consecutive three-year terms for each member. Deferring to Ms. Weaver, I believe I'm correct that the CFAC terms are 3 years and that they can only serve two consecutive terms. It's a little bit of a disjunct there then with regard to the capacity of the CFAC members to serve for three consecutive three-year terms. I could be wrong, Dr. Botts. And my second question is also for the Institute of Government. Under attendance, you have the following three absences members of the board may elect to require the member to step down. Would it be the case that the state ethics statutes would cover these groups of people? And if so, would the attendance requirements and so on not also apply to these groups? So it's a little bit different than the way the state ethics statute operates with regard to attendance.
I don't think there's any state statute that would govern the attendance of these boards. I mean, in terms of the law that was adopted, I guess it was a couple of years ago, that requires certain governing bodies to receive ethics training, that in itself does not apply to LMEs. So I think the answer to your question, if I understand it correctly, is no. And then on the first part, I'd have to look at the statute to see if there's a term limit for local CFAC members.
Actually, she's correct on that, Mr. Botts.
And if I misspoke, Mr. Botts, perhaps it's not based in statute, but certainly our committees, boards, councils are being directed to have our members attend 75% of the time, and I don't believe that there is a may in there that at least vest with the appointing authority. That would vest with the appointing authority. I'll leave that to you. I just wanted to point it out.
Okay. In terms of the terms of service, the local CFAC statute, the statute governing local CFAC says each CFAC shall adopt bylaws to govern the selection and appointment of it, the selection and appointment of its members, their terms of service, the number of members, and other procedural matters. So I think it's up to the CFAC to determine. Again, I haven't had a chance to, since you asked the question, to look the whole statute, but it appears that the CFAC, by its bylaws, determines term limits and length of terms. Now, there may be bylaws that need to be amended to allow for what we're talking about here in terms of a CFAC member serving three consecutive terms. I don't know.
Mr. Boss, just to make sure I'm understanding, a CFAC, what you're saying is under current statute, a CFAC could make that adjustment if they need to make that adjustment to accommodate that, yes or no? No?
I think that's true. Again, that's just real quickly looking at the statute as we're talking about it. But it appears to me that, and Sean, do you have some answer?
Yeah, I'm unfortunately right behind. I apologize. There's an express line that it's a three-year term for no more than two consecutive terms, so it would be a six-year limitation for a...
Yep. Well, wait a minute. You're saying it's a term of three years. Oh, no more than two consecutive terms. Correct. So that mimics the current LME board statute. So you may want to amend that to fit this proposal.
You could amend it at the same time.
If we were 3-3, we would need to adjust that in order to be fair, to give all the members, because part of the point of this is to make sure that all members of the board are treated equally in terms of their potential service therein. Okay. Other comments or observations or yes?
Quick question about attendance. The county commissioners, someone called me in my community, and we've got a county commissioner that's, I think, attended one meeting since he was elected, something like that. And is there a conflict? The fact that county commissioners can stay on as long as they are county commissioners on the board, that language doesn't supersede a county commissioner also being asked to step down. We don't have statute yet that requires attendance. It's the the board can decide on a case-by-case basis. Is that how it's written now? About attendance? I can't remember. But anyway, I'm concerned about even when it's a county commissioner, we really need invested county commissioners, and if there's one that's not going to care enough about that role to attend, my hope is that he's treated no differently than the rest of the members as far as attendance.
Mr. Botts or Mr. Parker, either one.
John got the last one right. I'm going to let him take this one.
Right. Currently, there's no language speaking to attendance requirements. They serve at the pleasure. From what, as Representative Dollar indicated, I've done an initial draft, or I've started drafting some of this language, in which case it would account for a county commissioner or a county manager's term. Everyone would be in line. I'm striking through language that distinguishes those.
Yes, sir. I want to address another issue. Are you planning to put residency requirements, or that's not going to be part of the language? That means that people should reside in the area that the LME is represented.
Well, I think the answer to that question would be yes. And is that currently in statute? That's something that could be added. I mean, that's just my off the top of my head thought. Would anybody see a problem with that if we wanted that clarified, that those board members would? I mean, obviously, county commissioners would be just by virtue of, but since there would be others on there.
And the second question is, are you going to put some qualifying notes on the appointee of the secretary? That means, can the secretary appoint one of his employees? For example, he wishes to live in a different place. Or, I'm just asking the question.
All right. Well, in this case, they would not be, of course, they would not be a salaried person. They would be a member of the board. Like anyone else, we take a look at that in terms of maybe we would want to say, and it would not be an employee of the department that would be the, because it would not be the intent, let me put it like that, it would not be the intent that the secretary would appoint someone that was an employee of the department to fill that role, but rather it would be just in the normal course of what you think of as an appointment, you know, from the community. And I do want to, I think it would be wise for us to leave the requirements fairly open. I mean, obviously somebody from that area, and as you're mentioning, hadn't thought of before, but someone who's not an employee of the department, so the secretary would have some latitude in terms of that appointment.
Yeah, I just want to clarify that secretary, of course, have great employees, but it may feel funny to have somebody that's writing the regulations and monitoring the contract appointed to serve in that board that is legislating. So that I just wanted to ask the question.
That's right, and that would not be the intent. The intent was would not be for the secretary to appoint an HHS employee from that area to the board. It would be a public member like anyone else, but the secretary could take into account maybe some difficulties in terms of who was represented on the board, you know, assess the board's strengths, weaknesses, what have you, in terms of making that appointment. Mr. Norman.
Yes, would it be the intent then for the secretary's appointment to be someone who meets one of the other criteria already listed?
Well, I think they could, and that gets back to something that was mentioned previously. I think we would, frankly, want to be careful. This is just my sort of personal view of it. I think we'd want to be careful to say, oh, well, okay, somebody meets four requirements, you know, four areas. if it's to the purpose of saying, because there's two different shades of that. On the one hand, if you say, well, I got this one person and they meet all these four requirements, and so they're the person, as opposed to saying, you know, maybe this person fills a couple of the roles. I mean, let's say, for I guess an easy example would be to say, okay, we've got a county commissioner in one of these counties who's really as a financial expert. It would fit that qualification. That person could serve those dual purposes. Could, in other words, satisfy that requirement for that expertise to be on the board. But you could also have, Commissioner Carruth has pointed out, he serves as a county commissioner, but he's also a family member, and I think that would be a good thing, because you, by virtue of that, you could have more than the three that would be assured of being on there. You could, by virtue of the connections that other people would bring to the board, either as commissioners or fulfilling some of the other roles, they may be consumer families as well and bring that to the table.
Aren't we really, and if you think about it, in essence, I mean, because we had a problem several years ago on our board of commissioners with our planning and zoning commission, where it was pretty much had become a board of political patronage, you know, and so you did not necessarily have people that had a interest in land use planning or balancing the needs of developers, builders, landowners, property owners versus what the community as a whole wanted. So we developed the questionnaire that you had to fill out as a supplement to the application that we could judge and evaluate whether you were the right person for that. And aren't we trying to really, and this is what we're saying, is doing that through this, because we don't want our governing boards to end up to be boards of political patronage. So we have it filled up with people that really don't really care, and they're just filling it because it looks good on a, you know, their qualifications or resume or something like that. I don't think anybody gets rich serving on these boards, so it wasn't anything there. So, but, you know, that's just really kind of what we're trying to do. So I don't, you know, I think, again, the understanding that's the intent. I think that somewhere needs to be stated. What is the intent, so that we don't just get looking just at, okay, we're meeting the letter of the law, or we're also meeting the spirit of it as well with what we're trying to do here. So.
Well, and we could certainly, I hadn't thought about this, but we could certainly include on any bill that would be introduced statement of purpose, intent, language. Legislation is often introduced with that sort of thing, and we may want to, that may be a good idea to frame that in that way. Okay, other comments or questions or issues that you would like to raise at this time on, Ms. Copeland?
Representative Dollar, I just want to reiterate Mr. Norman's statement earlier about the possibility of rural counties not being able to fill the specialty positions. And I don't know, one, I would love to hear from someone, what would be the impact if an LME MCO could not fill that position, maybe in a timely manner, or, you know, what would be the implications? Because I believe off the top of my head that there could be contractual implications, because I believe you have to be obviously in compliance with all state and federal statutes. So there could be contractual implications for their MCO contract if they were not able to fill all of the specialty positions without any type of a substitute provision or something. I don't know. So I guess I'm more concerned about those rural counties, rural areas where, Smoky Mountain, where there's not a lot of professionals out there necessarily. And certainly it's difficult to get someone to volunteer for something, you know, of this magnitude. So just wondering what the implications
would be. Let me come in a couple of ways. I mean, we can go back and think, see if we can think through that and get some, be happy to for us between now and the next meeting to get some feedback on that question, some thoughts on that question, because the only the one hesitation I have about that is that I think we want to make sure, and I think the committee, you know, by in those prior meetings, wanted to ensure that we had, because of what we're doing, that level of expertise on there that's really important. And you don't want, you would not, it would seem to me, want an escape hatch such that you could basically say, oh, well, that's there, but we really don't have to follow it. We don't have to look that closely to get what you're looking for. So that's, you know, that's kind of my, that's my personal hesitation on that. The other thought is that, of course, you know, most of these areas that we're talking about are going to have an Asheville or a Wilmington or a Greenville, certainly Triangle, Charlotte area, and the surrounding areas in there. I wouldn't think it would be, you know, Hickory. I mean, those areas wouldn't necessarily create a problem, I think, in being able to find someone with the appropriate level of expertise. But that's something we can try to think through between now and the next meeting. Yes, sir. Mr. Norman.
Just one additional comment related to that. I see these criteria as just being the first step. Sure, I'm sure I have lots of people in Wilmington who might be an attorney with healthcare experience, but more important question is, are any of them interested in sitting on an area authority board?
I think that's a point well taken, and Mr. Carruth was making, I think, that point as well, and that you have to have people who are willing to serve. And we're talking about not an inconsequential commitment of time and energy to do it right, and we want people to do it right, because if the boards are not functioning effectively, it's going to be very difficult to have the system that we want to have, and I think that's going to be a critical element moving forward. There's no question about that. Other comments? Our questions or concerns at this point. Let's do this. Let's pass out. We don't have, we've been good about not taking folks past the 5 o'clock hour in our subcommittee meetings, because some folks have a long way to travel to go back. But I think what we can do is we can pass out these next three items that are powers of the LME-MCO. And if you'll take these and kind of review through them, like I say, this is part of a document that you had received early on in the process. And you may or may not have looked at those. You may have different reactions to them, but they were potential barriers or identified barriers that we need to take a look at and talk about how they operate, what we can do, what we need to do, maybe what we don't need to do to address these in any potential legislation for the short session. So rather than sort of getting into a truncated conversation at this point, take those, look those, like say, any comments that you want to send back to Dr. Porter and Mr. Parker. Dr. Porter, of course, has been coordinating these, and we appreciate all the feedback we've been getting in the interim. And we will pick back up with these at the at our next meeting. And our next meeting is April. Trying to remember now. Yeah, but what's the April? Our next meeting is April 9th, and one of the things that we've been looking at in terms of our schedule is being able to put something together and have it for the short session. And I think initially we were looking at April 9th as being the last meeting for this governance subcommittee. And I don't think that's a workable thing. So what we are looking to do, unless there's a major concern by the members here of the committee, is setting a meeting in May, which will be prior to, it'll be the meeting prior to, like we've been doing, we're meeting the day prior to the HHS Joint Oversight Committee. And our report will go to the Joint Oversight Committee for action. So what I'm suggesting is that we, if you weren't otherwise planning on it, that we plan on meeting in May before that last oversight committee meeting, and we can finalize recommendations that we would have to be presented to the oversight committee for their action before the beginning of the short session. The short session begins, I believe, at noon on the 16th, and our meeting would be the 14th of May. So that we try to wrap up what we can wrap up with this subcommittee in April and May. All right, I see some nodding heads. Any other questions or comments? If not, again, I appreciate everybody's work on this and all of your contributions, and we are adjourned till April the 9th. Thank you. Here.